You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 206 by Rudolf Steiner, 11 lectures translated by Matthew Barton, entitled The Human Being as Spiritual Being, Evolving Through the Course of History. This is Lecture 7, given in Dornach on the 12th of August, 1921. Now, it is true to say that the methods of observation, analysis, and judgment that have developed over the last 3 to 4 centuries and have become customary today cannot, as they stand, be simply introduced into anthroposophic spiritual science. What intellectual concepts initially indicate is only a kind of guideline in anthroposophy that points us toward a place where we can survey reality, full reality. Thus, in the basic ideas of spiritual science, we have scarcely more than a schema that draws our attention to certain observational methods. These schemas are drawn from a spiritual science that has reached a certain degree of completeness, so that someone who engages with it receives something which, while already offering illumination for the faculties of healthy common sense, can only be fully understood if these schemas are filled out with what science and life can bring to them. If someone decides to acquaint themselves with anthroposophic spiritual science, they gain such a schema relatively quickly. And this schema is what leads us to base our view of the human being on physical body, etheric body, astral body, and I, capital. In my book titled Theosophy, I was already trying to convey these four members, or aspects of human nature, in more than a merely schematic way, to fill out these four otherwise abstract terms with a certain tangible content. To a certain degree, therefore, and more than this cannot be done, people can thereby see the full justification for considering the human being in terms of this classification of the four members. But these things come vividly and tangibly to life when we engage with what manifests in human life, what reveals itself in our human relationships with the world, and in the world itself altogether. This fills initially only schematically outlined concepts with very specific content. Today I want to try to study this from a particular point of view. Let us begin with what we call our I, capital, insofar as we experience it consciously, experience what this I of ours actually constitutes. As you know, this I, as conscious awareness, is interrupted in our lives by all the conditions that unfold between falling asleep and waking up again. Apart from dreaming, and actually even in dreaming to a certain extent, this I consciousness disappears while we sleep. We can say that this I consciousness always lights up at the moment of awakening. Lighting up, of course, being used here metaphorically, and is extinguished as we fall asleep. If we develop an ability to observe such things, we will notice that this I consciousness is intimately bound up with the whole scope of our sensory perceptions, and really only with these. You can conduct a kind of inner experiment here, which involves ridding yourself in the waking state of all sensory content, as it were, looking away from all such content. Later we will come back to this from a different angle. But if you try this experiment, you will notice that in the great majority of cases, and in the great majority of people, this will lead to a certain tendency to succumb to a kind of sleep. And this in turn means dulling the wakefulness of the I. It can be observed that I consciousness, as it holds sway in waking life, is very largely involved in the presence of sense perceptions. And so we can say that we experience our I simultaneously with sensory content. In ordinary, everyday consciousness, we really experience our I only with and through sense perceptions. I consciousness is present as long as there is sensory content, and insofar as I consciousness is present, at least in ordinary life, sense content accompanies it. Initially, it is completely justified from the perspective of this ordinary, everyday consciousness to see the I as one with sensory contents, to say that the I exists when the color red, or this or that tone, or this or that sensation of warmth, touch, taste, and smell also exist. Whenever these sensations are absent, then the I, as we experience it in ordinary waking life, is absent too. I have often described this as a finding of inner self-observation. In a lecture I gave at the Philosophy Congress in Bologna in 1911, I presented this with particular clarity. There I tried to show how what is experienced as the I really should not be sundered from the whole scope of our sensory experiences. So we must say that the I is essentially bound up initially, and I'm talking here always of our experience of it, with sense perceptions. For the time being, we are not considering the reality of the I. But during this series of three lectures, today, tomorrow, and the day after, we will turn toward this reality. First, though, let us consider what we call the I experience that we have in daily life. You know how difficult it is to live in abstract thoughts that are not suffused with sensory content. There are even philosophers who claim that such sense-free thinking, a thinking devoid of the presence of some kind of sense perceptions, is impossible, even if these perceptions be ones reflected from within. Well, real inward self-observation will soon show that actually, our inward experience is not exclusively involved in sense perceptions, that in fact we pass from these sense perceptions to what we call thoughts. But we only gain a clear picture of such thought if we can carefully examine what happens to a complex of sense perceptions from which we have turned away our senses, and which we afterward only picture to ourselves, though now by drawing on the same powers that otherwise serve us in remembering. Of course, we cannot claim that the content of our sense perceptions does not enter into these thoughts, but the activity we can observe in human soul life is different depending on whether we are experiencing a sense perception in connection with the outer world or merely picturing this sensory perception. This life of thought we have leads us a long way from what largely constitutes our I experience during sense perception. We cannot say that we have the same strong I consciousness when we are merely thinking or picturing. On the contrary, when only thinking or picturing, there is a continual tendency for this I experience to grow fainter, something that comes to expression in transitions into a dreamy state or even into a somnolent one when we are merely thinking. When only thinking or picturing, we immerse ourselves deeper in our interiority than when living in sense perceptions in immediate connection with the outer world. Each person must make this observation for themselves. Then you can notice the tendency for the eye to grow duller or fainter when sense perceptions are silenced. What happens is that we move on from our eye into our astral body when we connect thought with sense experience. So it's like this. Just as life in sense perceptions belongs with eye experience, so thought experience belongs to the astral body. Really, the most significant thing we must remember when trying to understand what I'm saying here is that remaining with sense perceptions gives us something very individual. The complex of sense perceptions that we have before us at any moment is one that no one else can have in the same way. It is something distinctly individual, and it is this individual quality that gives us our I experience. But insofar as we rise to an experience of thought, we have at the same time the capacity to enter into something more general and universal, for instance, to create abstractions, in which form they can then be conveyed to others and understood by them in the same way as we understand them. Only we ourselves can understand the sense perceptions we have individually throughout our life. But the thoughts we relate to these perceptions assume a more generally valid form that can be communicated to a larger number of people. But this already demonstrates that the I is dimmed as we ascend from sense experience to thought experience. Yet at the same time, we go more deeply into ourselves, as we can experience it firsthand. Now, as thoughts, or rather what unfolds within us to give rise to them, and what, for the time being today, we will leave vague, develops further, these thoughts become memories. Thoughts initially fade, really, from our awareness. Out of certain foundations, which we are not yet defining, realities arise as a consequence of which we can call forth the same thoughts again. We can assert nothing more than that. If we stay with the facts, then we cannot agree with the psychologists who say that thoughts go down into the subconscious, go for a stroll, if you like, without our conscious minds knowing about it. And that when we remember something, they stroll back up again. That is not factual. Nothing suggests that a thought I conceived 3 years ago continues its underground existence until I think it again today, has simply strolled away somewhere into the depths of the soul before surfacing again when I recall it. The only thing we can say, if we are to speak precisely, is this: I formed thoughts at a particular moment, and the capacities that were involved in and conjunct with this forming of a thought are well suited, as they continue, to enable this thought to appear consciously in me again. That is the only reality that we can assert. And if people were always inclined to deal with precise facts, there would, I am quite sure, be far fewer theories and hypotheses in the world than there are. You see, specifically, in relation to what I am saying here, most people believe that the thought they once conceived goes on living in some vague and undefined locus and then strolls up into their minds again. But we also know that the thought we form in relation to a sense experience is transitory, and that even though this is not always apparent, an inner power or activity must be developed when a past experience is to become thought again in our memory. What gives rise to memory pictures or remembered thoughts lies deeper in us than do ordinary sense-derived and related thoughts. The former is a memory picture or thought rooted in our organism, connected also with what we are as temporal beings. We know that thoughts can be recalled in a variety of ways, depending on whether the originating experience occurred a shorter or longer time ago. If we summarize all the facts involved here, then we have to say that, at any rate, what lived in a thought linked to a sense perception has entered the flow of time in which we live ourselves. Certain feelings we have when a memory surfaces tell us how memory is in fact connected with our whole organization. And we also know how the power of memory is greater or less at different phases of life, thus in the sequence of our lives between birth and death. If we trace all these realities carefully, then we will be able to see that just as the power of thought lies in the astral body, so the power of memory lies in the etheric body. Thus, summing up our power of recollection in the word memory, this faculty is one with the etheric body just as our life of thought is one with the astral body, and sense perception is one with the eye. Or at least what underlies thought is taken up into the temporal course of our existence. Just as our growth, our ongoing development between birth and death is involved in a certain stream of time, so what can be experienced as memory, what reveals itself in remembering, is also involved in this same stream. We can feel how they belong together. But now something else needs to be considered alongside what I have so far described, something which everyone can discover with careful self-observation and a degree of nuanced attention. It is quite clear that the eye is connected with sensory perception, and anyone who fails to acknowledge this is simply refusing to notice something quite apparent. That the life of thought is connected with the astral body is again something that we can arrive at by ordinary observation. But a subtler power of discernment is needed to study how etheric body and memory belong together. But we can give what can be called scientific grounds even here, if especially we observe pathological cases, memory disturbances, and so forth, and see how they are connected particularly with growth and nutritional disorders. The powers of nutrition must be seen as very much in line with growth forces or reproductive forces. Certainly we can conceive an observational series which allows us to recognize the way in which memory is bound up with the etheric body. On the other hand, what I now need to add becomes clear only to imaginative observation. Ordinary observation can at most only have an inkling of it, if I can put it like that. But once discovered through imaginative observation, the whole context of these things proves itself correct to healthy common sense. In a sense, we pass ever deeper inward into our being, from outside inward. First sense perception and eye, then thought experience and astral body, then memory experience and etheric body, before delving still further down into the physical body. In the physical body, however, we are concerned with something that is still connected with memory, albeit in a different way from the etheric body. To better understand this, we can draw on what is evident to imaginative observation, which I will describe here. We can draw on the findings from various disorders. In such cases, a person acquires certain tendencies in the physical body. These need not be so extreme as to produce involuntary movements, twitches, or convulsions, though this can, of course, be the case. It can become so extreme as to culminate in death, but that belongs to another field of investigation. But if involuntary movements of a less culpable form, we could say, arise, then anyone who seeks to study such things can discover the after effects of past experiences in these involuntary movements. If someone shows the tendency to perform some kind of habitual but involuntary action with their fingers, say, then, with enough documentary evidence, we can demonstrate how a particular experiential complex leads to such things. Such movements need not be excessively involuntary. You might call them half involuntary. You see, what happens is that an experience someone has had impresses itself too strongly into the physical body. It is fine for experiences to impress themselves into the etheric body, but they should not engrave themselves too far into the physical body. If this occurs, then the physical body becomes subject to the influence of memories. This ought not to happen. Imaginative observation shows us that what is at work in memory is still in movement in the etheric body. In a sense, is still a developing movement there, whereas it becomes a congestion, a blockage in the physical body. It ought not to fully penetrate the physical body. The physical body should repulse it. If I were to draw this schematically, it would be like this, and there's a diagram. Let's assume this is the physical body here, and here is the etheric body, then the astral body is here, and finally we have the I here. Now a sense experience occurs and is first absorbed into the I. The thought is associated with it as it works its way into the astral body, and then the power that makes memory possible takes effect as it works its way into the etheric body as movement. But now it will inevitably get blocked. It must not go any further. It must not penetrate the physical body, but must be blocked here. There arises in the physical body, of course initially, completely unconsciously, an image of what lives in the memory. The image has no resemblance to the original experience, but is a metamorphosis of it, yet an image arises. And so it must be said that just as a memory is connected with the etheric body, so a real inner image is connected with the physical body. When a movement coming from the etheric body gets blocked in this way, then the physical body is always impregnated with a picture, an image. Naturally, we can only access this image by means of imaginative thinking. Then we see how, in fact, the physical body becomes the bearer of all these pictures. You might object that it is impossible to have an image, say that of a church tower, in your physical body. Let me give you an idea of what this means, first of all, of how you could actually have the picture of a church tower in your physical body. Let me show you this metaphorically. Let's assume you have a face in front of you, one that you allow to be reflected in some kind of mirror that completely distorts it. Let's assume this face acquires something terrible, a horrible aspect. Now, I do not mean that the outward experience, say that of a church tower, gives rise to such a terrible thing in its picture impregnation of the physical body. Rather, something different arises there. Imagine if this beautiful star here were to give rise to something monstrous, then this would be caused by the distorting curvature of the mirror. You could reconstruct the original face, if it were no longer present, from its distorted caricature due to the mirror's curvature. In other words, if you understood the properties of the caricature creating mirror surface, you could reconstruct the original face from this caricature. There is, therefore, no need for something resembling a church tower or a drama we witnessed or such like to be present within us, but rather what arises here in connection with the nature of the whole human being renders it quite possible to reconstruct the experience in the same way. This gives the lie to the objection that since the world is big and formed differently from our inner being, the picture cannot reside there. The picture or image exists there, and the image is, in a sense, the final stage at which an outward experience arrives. The rest, thinking, remembering, are transitional stages. What we experience of the outer world must not simply pass through us. We have to be isolators. We have to hold back the experience, which is what our physical body finally does. Our astral body alters it, renders it as the pale cast of thought. Our etheric body deprives it of all content, retaining only the capacity to recollect it again, call it forth. But what is really brought about within us impresses itself in us as image, and then we live on with it. But we must not let it simply pass through us. Let us assume that we let a thought pass straight through us, that it was not, let us say, elastically reflected back by the etheric body. Let's assume it passed straight through the etheric body and through the physical body. Then we would invariably flipper to gibbet about in the world as events dictated. These processes cannot be easily described in relation to more complex scenarios, but Let me give this example. If I saw a person moving from right to left, then I myself would immediately have to dance from left to right, would want to immediately imitate what I have seen. Within me and my form and figure, I would try to imitate everything I had seen outside me. But what happens instead is that what I see arrives first in the astral body, which already lames it to a degree, then in the elastically reflective etheric body, and then particularly in the physical body, which blocks and holds up the whole thing. Here occurs an isolation of what I perceived outside me. And it is in this way that what I experience of the outer world acts within me. By knowing that the human being consists of physical body, etheric body, astral body, and I, we possess a schema. But then it is a matter of filling out this schema with tangible findings. Thus here with sense perception, thought, memory, and then the very concrete image. Only then do these schematic concepts acquire real content, which is what we increasingly need if we are to gain understanding of the world's realities. For instance, we cannot say that there are clear fixed divisions between the physical body, etheric body, astral body, and I. If we are sensible, we will certainly not assert to begin with that there are other divisions than those that arise when we study the forming of images, the experience of memory, the experience of thought, and that of sense perception. But we have to be open-minded in our apprehension of the distinctions between these four types of experiences. So, that is, first of all, one way to approach these things. But now, let us consider the human being and his relationship with and conduct toward the world from another angle. Imagine that we are walking around, and that as we do so, I touched on this on a previous occasion in a different context, we cannot discern any difference for outer observation between our own motion and the movement of an inanimate object. For outer observation, the same fact presents itself, the fact of movement, irrespective of whether I am observing a stone someone has thrown, or a human being who runs or walks. If I ignore everything else and consider only a body in motion, then I witness a change of location in the case of both the stone and the human being. I observe this change of position, this speed of movement. And ultimately, this is really how we are conscious of our movement in ordinary life. You see, we have to distinguish between the intention to perform a movement and the movement itself. When I think of myself in motion, I can remain perfectly still. I can think of myself in movement, and if I have a little imagination, I can picture this motion of mine. And the picture or thought I have, when I am actually moving, need not be any different from the imaginary picture I have when I am still and am merely picturing myself in movement. So we have to distinguish very carefully between thinking, picturing our movements, and our actual movements. But we only outwardly picture these actual movements in the very same way as we picture that of inanimate objects. We see ourselves gaining distance in various ways from these or those objects. We recognize our movements in an entirely external way. And when we speak of movements, when we are studying movements, and here I don't wish to engage with the question of whether we are dealing with a hypothetical thought or one that is more or well-founded, for that would be the subject of a different study, then energy is also involved. So initially I only want to keep to the ordinary state of affairs. Wherever there is movement, a certain energy is, of course, at work. We can say that someone in movement develops a certain energy. We cannot speak of more than energy and must associate this energy they develop with some object or other, even an inorganic one. So if we are only considering the physical body, either as a whole or in its separate parts, we find that when it moves, it does so in the same way as any lifeless object. Thus, when we think of ourselves in movement and consider only the physical body, we can here speak only of energy. But when we begin to study the inner nature of a living being, things look different. We have to be clear that when we perform a movement, inner processes are at work in us. Substances are consumed. Something occurs that is connected with the forces of growth, of nutrition, or reproduction. These are forces that we cannot consider in the same way as we consider the forces at work when we perceive the outward movement of an inanimate object. If we observe the growth of a plant, we have to recognize that what is at work as a plant grows ever taller, and this is equally true of the growth forces at work in humans or animals. Involves the development of an energy that is different from what we find in the motion of a merely outwardly observed object, whether this be the outward observation of our own body in movement or that of any human body. What occurs when growth forces are at work, and in a broader sense growth forces are also involved when we are in motion, for instance, must be sought in the etheric realm, in the etheric body. What we observe in the form of outward movement, in the relationship someone has in outward movement with this outward world, will not lead us to consider the etheric body. The moment we observe what is inwardly happening, then we have to consider the etheric body. And if we take the concept of growth in a broader sense, as I have just done, we must say that the specific force of growth that is also involved in nutrition, the consuming of substances and so forth, compels us to consider the etheric body. We see these growth forces at work in the world of plants. So that you can see that these things are not merely randomly conceived, but can also be substantiated by spiritual scientific observations, I will expressly state that what we observe in the growing, or also generally inwardly changing organism, especially in the plant organism, where this figures in purest form, is very much dependent on the energy that otherwise only expresses itself in movement, coming into a certain relationship with what we can indeed call ether. And I want to bring this home to you in vividly pictorial form. As you know, and is often stated, a solid body, in a fluid, loses weight, acquires uplift, in a proportion equal to the weight of the water displaced by it. Now, the forces underlying the outer movements of physical bodies are rigid, in a certain sense. They possess an inner rigidity, in just the same way as a solid body possesses a certain weight. If you place a solid object into water, it loses some of its weight. And if you inwardly permeate with etheric forces, the forces that otherwise cause outer movement, they lose this rigidity and become inwardly mobile. Thus, an energy which, as impelling force in the inorganic realm, is of a certain degree and cannot grow any larger if it is only an outer force of movement, loses its rigidity when combined with the ether. Then it can expand or also contract. And such a force is active in growth and in all inward processes. This Archimedean principle can be expressed in fact as follows. Every solid body loses as much of its weight in a fluid as the weight of the fluid it displaces. But then we can continue by stating that every energy that unites with etheric forces loses as much of its rigidity as the etheric forces exert forces of suction upon it, as the etheric forces bring forces of suction to bear upon it. It becomes movement, and as such becomes what it becomes in its activity in, let's say, the plant organism, but also in the animal and human organism. If we now ascend further from the etheric body to the astral body, and thus in outward observation from the plant to the animal, so what was initially an inwardly mobile force becomes free, similar to how I described the emancipation of forces at the age of 7, with the change of teeth. What now occurs is no longer bound up with the forces of the solid body. The free forces express themselves as instinctual forces in animals and humans. So that, working our way upward to the astral body, we come to instinct as a lower force. And working our way further upward to the I, instinctual action becomes will. Small chart. I, sense perceptions, will. Astral body, life of thought, instinct. Etheric body, memory, growth forces. Physical body, picture, energy. In unprejudiced study of ordinary soul life, in rational self-observation, this relationship of the will to the instincts becomes apparent. And now, from another angle, we have filled with experiential content what is otherwise a mere schema. When we consider the physical body, we can say that from within it shows itself to us as something that continually meets our experiences to block them and render them image, picture. And it is also a true observation of the physical body to say that it actually consists of an interplay of forces and images. Picture a painted image to yourself, though now you would have to picture it in spatially dynamic terms, not as a rigid image, but an inwardly mobile one, with energy pulsing everywhere in it. And then you have something that we must in reality picture when we conceive of the physical body. If you picture the inner aspect of the growth forces, and on the other hand conceive of them as being saturated by what underlies memory, though not now as interleaving thoughts, but as the matrix of memory, thus etheric movements on the one hand, which surge upward, swell, and accumulate upward through their inner assimilation of nutrients, which swell and coalesce upward through a person's movements, in conflict with what percolates downward from everything that is perceived in sensory fashion and has become thought, and then has faded away in the etheric body to preserve memory. When you conceive of this interplay from above and below, thus what resonates downward from thought and what rises from below from processes of nutrition, growth, and digestion, both playing into each other, then you gain a living picture of the etheric body. And then in turn, if you think of everything that you experience yourself when instincts are at work, understanding, as you well can, how blood circulation, breathing, the whole rhythmic system are at work in our instincts, and how these instincts are dependent on our education, on what we have absorbed, then you have the living interplay of the astral body. And then finally, if you think of the interplay of acts of will, the kindling of all will impulses, with sense perceptions, then you have a living picture of how the eye works its way into conscious awareness. But this is a mere schema. The experiences themselves, and here we have touched only on a very small part of them, must inform the schema. You have to have a cupboard first before you can put things into it. Ordinary psychologists or physiologists first observe things, and if it happens that someone has all sorts of laundry and articles of clothing, but no cupboard, so that he merely puts things on top of each other, then eventually chaos reigns. And that is the nature of modern psychology and physiology. You need a cupboard. And just as the carpenter who makes the cupboard needs to know how it is to be internally divided, so that what is meant to go inside, it will really fit, so also the divisions and parts of the whole schema must be well constructed, even though it remains as abstract as a cupboard does when it's empty. The schema will remain as inexplicable to begin with as an empty cupboard is, really. So, you see, there are, of course, a great many ways to approach anthroposophy, depending on where you start from. But you can, as I try to do in title Theosophy, keep showing that although the cupboard has to be there to start with, it needs something tangible to fill it. Then you have to have the patience to embrace what introduces a wealth of detail into the schema. We have to keep saying this in particular to anthroposophists, that it is important to avoid giving the impression in public that such abstract terms as physical body, etheric body, astral body, and I are all that is needed. If you merely say that the human being consists of physical body, etheric body, astral body, and I, then all you have done is utter four concepts. There is a great difference, of course, whether these terms are drawn from a fullness of insight, as a schema that can then be used to hang many other clothes on, in quotes, or whether they are simply stated as abstract dogma. That's why it strikes me as so off-putting merely to state boldly that the human being consists of physical body, etheric body, astral body, and I. It all depends on how you say these things. There is no need to go to the lengths that someone supposedly went to once in an anthroposophic lecture, when they stated that, quote, for the sake of simplicity, we divide human nature into seven aspects, close quote. It is nonsense to think that you come anywhere near reality when you simply set up some kind of schema. It is there initially to provide guidelines within which observations can then be made. Now that I have shown you how one can introduce certain common concepts such as will, memory, and so forth, into the schema of anthroposophic terms, tomorrow we will pass on to a further consideration of the human being. The end of Lecture 7.